listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development.
I'll introduce the first speaker, which will be Katia Cujo, who's just edited the book Mineral Rents and the Financing of Social Policy, which is an UNRIS publication. Katia is a research coordinator of the UNRIS Social Policy and Development Program, and she's been at UNRIS since March 2006. And was previously conducting research and was a teaching fellow at the Latin American Institute at the Free University in Berlin.
Thank you very much, Peter, and thank you very much to everybody for being here today and for your interest in this subject. What I would like to do in my presentation is firstly to tell you how this specific project was designed within the UNRIS research agenda on social policy in a development context. Why I think that social policy in these debates has been a neglected issue, and what are the kind of findings and recommendations we can take away from this project. So first of all, I think it's important to say that when UNRIS started its very broad inquiry into the role of social policy for development, it became quickly clear that the financing issue was something that had been neglected in these debates. Because usually discussions and studies on social protection focus very much on social expenditures, but less so on the funding side of social development and social policies. And so what we tried to do in a broader project on financing social policy was really to see both sides of social policy in an integrated way, the funding side and the expenditure side. And our main question was really how governments could design social policies which are progressive and equitable and developmental, but at the same time, which are based on financial arrangements that pursue these same goals. When we started this inquiry, it became quickly clear that there is a specific set of countries, and these are the mineral-rich countries, which are a very interesting subset of countries when we talk about financing social policies. So we developed a sub-project within this broader research on financing social policy in mineral-rich countries. And this is the project where I want to talk about today. And I think the big puzzle that emerges when one talks about, let's say, the potential for social development in mineral-rich countries is that many of these countries continue to be poor, low-income countries with a lot of characterized by a lot of social and economic development problems. And whereas on the one hand we have enthusiasm about the potential that mineral revenues bring for social development, on the other hand there is quite a big amount of skepticism, and this skepticism has been labeled as the paradox of plenty. So the question is whether mineral-led development is specifically, let's say, difficult or challenging growth path for late industrializers. And I think a lot of this debate is shaped by what has been labeled the so-called resource curse thesis. Which is a more scholarly work, actually, based on empirical econometric studies, showing that there is a supposed negative relationship between natural resource abundance or dependence and growth performance. And this work has very much dominated policy, but also theoretical debates on mineral-rich countries in the recent past, or since the 1990s, I would say. However, there has been a lot of criticism on this literature, and I won't go into details about this criticism, which related to methodological issues, but more to the very deterministic conclusions of this literature, where basically it was said that we find, or it this negative correlation can be found, and behind this, empirical correlations are actually causal relationships. So these very much pessimistic prospects have been criticized, but also have kind of triggered a very rich and new debate on the potential of mineral wealth for development. And this is what drove our research. Basically, the question, what are the specific challenges associated with mineral-led development? What are potential constraints? But more importantly, what are the opportunities? And what are the conditions under which mineral-rich countries can actually channel more of their revenues into social development, and how they can actually come closer to a positive development outcomes. So what was very interesting about this theoretical inquiry about development in mineral-rich contexts is a very succinct and substantive investigation about the different challenges of mineral-led wealth, and which is, of course, not something that is new, but that has shaped development economics since its inception, I would say. But let me just very briefly summarize, just in a key words, these development challenges, which I have divided into economic, political, social, and environmental challenges, before I come to the more interesting, I think, findings and implications of our research, how social policy can have a positive impact with regard to these different challenges. So first of all, we have economic challenges in a context of mineral-led development, which are usually described by Dutch disease, which is, of course, the challenge that emerges when countries have a lot of foreign exchange inflows because of exports and have to cope or manage the macroeconomic and currency, the inflationary and currency appreciation pressures in order to avoid detrimental effects on the manufacturing or other sectors in the economy. Other challenges are related to the enclave nature. So if the most dynamic sector of an economy is actually an enclave, the question comes up how to diversify that economy and how to create actually linkages that offer more employment possibilities and more productive opportunities for other sectors in the economy as well. There are also a lot of political challenges. And this, I think, relates to the simple fact that who captures rents from extractive industries and how are these rents actually allocated or distributed. So there is a whole literature actually on these questions and whether one can relate specific rent-seeking activities, corruption, distributional conflicts, or even the financing of violent conflicts to the existence of natural resource abundance in countries. There are also a lot of social challenges associated with mineral-led development, and I just want to emphasize the impact of mineral-led development on inequalities. It can be shown that, let's say, the concentration of economic activities and if the most dynamic economic sector is an enclave sector like mining, this usually adds to income inequalities, regional inequalities, but also in a way to gender inequalities in a country. So we have these social challenges in terms of inequalities, which are already significant in many developing countries, but tend to be even more pronounced in mineral-rich contexts. And last but not least, the environmental challenges, the ecological cost associated with extractive industries. This is something probably that receives one of the most attention in global debates, and this is something also where most of the social mobilization actually occurs from the ground. The discussion about depletion of resources, pollution, and destruction of the environment, and also new challenges that come up now with climate change and green economy debates. Now, nevertheless, despite all these challenges we can identify, what is also a fact, and this is probably also the good news, is that in many countries, not to say in most of the developing countries that have experienced high growth rates more recently, actually the natural resource-based sectors are the driving sectors behind that. And this can be explained by a lot of factors, but one is, of course, quite a favorable, still volatile, but favorable environment globally in terms of demand and prices. New incentives for investments, some of which, for example, emerged in the context of the global crisis in terms of increased portfolio investments, also in commodity or financial commodity markets, but also more incentives for foreign direct investment, new technologies, of course, a certain path dependency for many developing countries, which have started off their growth models based on natural resources. But also, and this is maybe interesting and also explains some of the concerns many countries have, as Peter explained, the impact of the more recent globalization processes and neoliberal policies, where actually a lot of countries find that they reorient their economies towards comparative advantages because they have become less competitive in their more manufacturing in their manufacturing sectors. So this is what in Latin America is discussed as reprimarization. Now, the concern of many countries, especially more the middle-income countries, which experienced commodity booms more recently, but also for the low-income countries that put a lot of hopes, let's say, in the potential of mineral-led development, is that that there are long-term objectives, of course. So mineral-led development can be a positive development strategy if it combines stability and sustainability, diversification, eventually leading to more productive diversification linkages, value added, more qualified employment, and inclusive and democratic development. Now, one of the key questions we pursued in this research project is actually, given that context, and given these multiple challenges mineral-rich countries face, what is the role that social policy can play in this process? And I think that the role of social policy for mineral-led development has been neglected or underestimated due to two reasons. On the one hand, especially the resource-curse literature, but traditionally, the economic development literature for resource-rich countries has focused on challenges of macroeconomic stabilization and on good governance. So social policy was usually not part of this debate. And second, when social policy came into the picture, it was usually interpreted as a threat to this macroeconomic stability, and it was seen as an instrument that especially what is also labeled predatory or the undemocratic regimes have tended to use in order to perpetuate their regime. So what is also called populist or redistributive regimes. So in a way, social policy was or absent, or when it was brought into the debate, it was seen very critical. And I think what we show in this book and in this research is actually that social policy can indeed be a very forceful and very powerful instrument, especially to tackle the challenges that mineral-rich countries face. Now, how can this be done? And I have to go through this very quickly in order not to go beyond our time limit. But social policy investments have a very beneficial impact in terms of growth and sustainability. Just one example in this sense. Come out that it is very difficult to diversify an economy through so-called fiscal linkages, because the problems that governments had was to identify the sector that would be the best, let's say, sector to invest part of the revenues in order to diversify the economy. If proceeds from the mineral or extractive industries are invested in social policy, and this leads to, let's say, creation of a knowledge economy, to higher quality education, to skills training, etc., then this adds really to the future economic potential of the economy in its whole. And it is not, it's a lot easier than to decide to allocate these resources to specific economic sectors. Stability and social protection. Of course, it is possible to combine the productive and the protective goals of social policy, and this is especially beneficial in resource-rich countries. And I think Chile and Norway are good examples where they have actually created funds that serve at the same time as stabilization and reserve funds, and on the other hand, for example, as pension funds. Employment. Norway is a very good example to show that there has been some sort of Dutch disease effects in the countries, and employment in manufacturing has actually declined since Norway has discovered oil. But at the same time, they have expanded employment in the social sectors very strongly, which has partly compensated for the decline in employment in the manufacturing sector. And this is also something that has actually reduced the gender bias that is so often inherent in mineral-led development, because especially investment in the social sectors offers opportunities for women in relatively stable and protected public employment. Social policy is also very important, and this is often underestimated, in order to create or foster social inclusion and cohesion in countries that are often struggling, actually, to forge these strong citizen-state relations and this level of trust, which is also beneficial for investor confidence and the general economic environment. And last but not least, political legitimacy, especially if countries are able to set up rights-based and universal social policies. This is really an instrument where they can avoid being perceived as populist or predatory regimes that capture rents for the private interest. And this does not only improve, let's say, social cohesion and state-citizen relations, but also can have a beneficial impact on growth and even donor relations. So this is the main message I would like to put out here and would like to discuss with you. And of course, we in the research we also have a couple of other recommendations which are more geared towards the institutional and economic policies and sector strategies and also the global environment. But I think I'm sure that Samuel and Alfredo will also refer to these conditions, so we can discuss this later. Just to finalize, and without going into the very rich country case studies which are in the book, I think some of the lessons we took out from especially the case studies is, and which can also contribute to this debate on the resource curse, is first, the country context, and also including the global context, is more important than resource abundance. So it is really not about what countries have, but what they make out of it. Secondly, mineral-led development has specific challenges that need to be addressed. So it is also true that even the successful cases have to struggle with the specific challenges an oil economy or a mineral-rich economy poses. So there needs to be a kind of really purposeful and deliberate strategy that tackles these challenges. And last but not least, I think the big challenge is really the balancing of economic and social goals and the governance and institutional setup that really enables countries to take advantage of the rents and to distribute them to the wider population. And at the same time, to safeguard the stability in political and economic terms that is needed to turn this opportunity into a long-term development strategy. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Katia. And I think for shedding light on that crucial question is of under what policy and institutional conditions can mineral rents work for more sort of inclusive patterns of development, and clearly showing the key role of social policy there. And I think filling an important gap in both the literature and policy thinking on the role of social policy. But we'll move on now to our second speaker, Samuel Asfaha, who's the program officer at the International Training Center at the ILO in Turin. Samuel is an economist working at the ITC for the last 5 years. His areas of work and interest are growth, employment, poverty, nexus, with a focus on international trade and work on labor markets and economic diversification. Samuel.
Thank you, Peter. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for being here. Before I start, I want to thank UNRIST and in particular Katja for giving me the opportunity to be part of this research project and this book. It was my pleasure to be part of it. So to build up on what Katja has already said, she raised a number of important issues and key messages, which was also addressed in the book. Now, I start by perhaps reshaping what you have said in terms of the challenges that this country is facing. So for me, I think five challenges are important when we deal with mineral-rich countries. One is these countries need to cushion their economy from excessive volatility. Now, this volatility comes because, as we know, mineral prices and commodity prices are extremely volatile. And the second source of volatility is the volatility in terms of the payment of these royalties, which are coming from the transnational corporations, the mining companies, and so on. So first, they need to cushion their economy from this excessive volatility. The second thing is the enclavity. The mineral sector is an enclave sector. It has very thin linkages with the rest of the economy. So it hires very few, very highly skilled workers. It's very capital-intensive sector as well. So then the issue of how do you create linkage between this enclaved sector and the rest of the economy is one major challenge which mineral resource-rich countries need to deal with. The third is the dash disease, as you said, the exchange rate appreciating, and then the tradable sector collapsing. This environmental sustainability you also mentioned. But I think perhaps another issue to mention, which is also related to depletion of resources, is the aspect of intergenerational equity, the right of the current generation vis-a-vis the next generation in terms of the use of these resources. So I think these are five critical issues that we need to take to keep into account when we deal with the mineral resource-rich countries. But before I go into my own deeper message, I mean my own specific message, the resource scarce thesis, which Katja mentioned, is an unfortunately wrong answer to a wrong question, the way I see it, because it focuses on certain correlations. I would say it's not even causality, but correlations between economic growth as measured by GDP growth and resource richness. I think the relationship could be very spurious in a sense, because it is devoid of any kind of historical, sociological, and institutional context. So it has unfortunately dominated the debate in the last two or three decades, and I see it as a destruction of efforts as well. I think the key question need to be what UNRIST asked in this question, in this project, meaning, one, what sort of economic policies, what sort of institutional policies would be able to allow mineral resource-rich countries to better use their resources, to leverage that resource, to achieve a sustained economic growth, which is inclusive. I think inclusiveness is the key word here. So my own intervention begins from the word inclusiveness. We said the mineral sector is an enclaved sector. So then one of the challenges they face is how do you create this linkage? In other words, how do you diversify not just the economy but the benefit? How should it be widely shared in a sustained way? And I think that's where the space for social policy coming in. Now, the first thing is, to the extent that we narrowly focused on economic growth and macroeconomic stability, then the focus will be how do you use mineral resources to be able to achieve a sustained economic growth, without looking into other variables, such as the social development. Now, if we narrowly focused on this variable, I think some international organizations do that. They focus on macroeconomic stability and economic growth as the major focus of economic policy management. Now, if that is our benchmark, if that is our yardstick, then we will nod approvingly for Botswana. We will say that is the way to go, because Botswana has remarkably achieved sustained economic growth, a very fast growth. It has also achieved a tremendous stability, macroeconomic stability, by all measures, in terms of its fiscal position, its reserves, its debt-to-GDP ratio. So by all standard measures, it has achieved a remarkable stability. But if you measure it from a social angle, why would a country which was one of the fastest-growing economies for many decades, remarkably stable country, failed to create employment? About 30% of its 2 million population do not have employment. About 60% of its youth, who are also educated with tertiary education, are unemployed. And a bunch of them are actually out of the labor force, so we're not even calculating them as unemployed. Inequality is high. Life expectancy is falling, mostly because of HIV and AIDS-related problems. But to the extent that we focus on economic growth and macroeconomic stability, I think the management of mineral resources become once again misguided, because you can achieve GDP growth. It's very challenging, as it's seen in many resource-rich countries, because they fall trap of the Dash disease problems, the overvaluation of their currency, and then the tradable sectors collapsing. So perhaps the benefit that comes from expanded exports in the mineral sector could be wiped off by collapse and shrinkage of other sectors. Now, we have seen this happening in many countries. But much of the challenge actually goes beyond achieving economic growth in its narrow sense. It's about how do you achieve this inclusive, widely shared economic prosperity for all. This is the challenge. So I think the issue of diversification in this sense need to be seen in two ways. One, you need to diversify, because it is when you diversify that many people can be engaged productively into the economy. So if you're just focusing on the mineral sector, as we said, it's enclaved, hires very few people. But if you move out and expand to other sectors which can absorb many people, then that's one way where you can assure inclusiveness. So I think the diversification issue should not be seen only as a way of diversifying your risk, but also as a way of expanding opportunity for inclusiveness. Because it's the other sectors that will be able to absorb many people in a productive way. So I think this is one. Second is, again, if you understood it this way, then social policy becomes an important tool in enhancing the capacity, I would say the social capability or social capacity is a critical thing. Education, health, and so on are key inputs into productivity. So the diversification issue needs to be once again framed into these elements. One is increasing the social capability, but also moving into sectors which can productively absorb many people, so that you achieve the inclusiveness aspect of economic development as well. But of course, this needs to be done, as we said. Of course, you have to pay close attention to the Dash disease problems as you spend, because as we said, remember, this is an enclaved sector. So the main policy tool for creating the linkage between this enclaved sector and the rest of the economy is the fiscal policy. It is once the resources come into state coffers, how are they going to be used? Now, many of the problems, you know, for example, at the beginning of my intervention, I mentioned volatility as a critical issue. So, for example, if the government's spending closely traces the revenue, then, of course, spending becomes extremely volatile. Now, this creates a huge problem. So one thing you need to do is you have to focus on how to smooth expenditure. And it's in this context, this sovereign wealth management, national revenue funds, and so on. You mentioned the case of Norway, for example, the Norwegian Petroleum Fund, the Botswanan Pula Fund, and so on, which is meant to save as part of the money during boom periods so that they could be used for sustained social spending or productive spending during periods of bust. So this becomes very critical. You have to keep a close eye on the Dash disease. That has to do with how you manage your exchange rate and so on. One thing which we observed in many mineral rich countries is you know, many of these investments were going to low return sectors as well, or low return investment endeavors. So I think another important thing is you have to look into the social and the social and economic benefit and cost of investment project itself. The social policy aspect is very, very critical, but you need to keep an eye on sustainability issues as well. One thing perhaps which I want to add is part of the problem has been, it's a paradigm problem in a sense that if you just focus on economic growth and employment and also development and so on will automatically follow with the trickle down theory. You just focus on economic growth and then the benefit will slowly trickle down. But I think we haven't seen that happening in many countries. What we see is, in fact, in certain countries, you see a trickle up, resources moving from the poor to the rich rather than being flowing the other way around. So I think the issue of the second question, combining economic policy and social policy, I think in this context, it's very clear you cannot take the two separately. The economic policy need to go hand in hand with social policy. And I don't see it as either or question. Is it either economic policy or social policy? I think you need to be able to achieve both. You need to be able to achieve economic growth. You need to be able to achieve macroeconomic stability. But then leveraging on your economic growth and macroeconomic stability, you have to be able to achieve, or at least target to achieve, social desirable social outcomes. Like, and you have to invest in education, health. Increasing what I call human capability, basically. So it's not an if or question in that context. 2 minutes, yeah. I will wrap up very quickly, talking a bit about what role can the international community play. Once again, the third question mentioned in the flyer. One key issue for me is. Many of these mineral-rich countries get advices from a number of international organizations, international advisory institutions, and so on. They get different advices. What they need, what these countries need, is a comprehensive and coherent approach to this huge macroeconomic and social challenge that they face. But the advices that they have been given is narrowly. I mean, each organization gives an advice based on its mandate. So it's not needs-driven. Advice for the countries. It is mandate-driven advice. Because my mandate is just on economic growth, I'll tell them how they're going to achieve economic growth. Because my mandate is on social policy, I will disregard every aspect of economic and social issue, I'll just focus on my narrow mandate. And I think what these countries have been receiving is a divided and sometimes incoherent and even contradictory policy advice. I think one thing which the international community need to do is perhaps we, different organizations need to sort out our message, need to be able to achieve some degree of coherence among ourselves. I think if we could do that, it's already a big thing for them. So other issues are transparency and promoting rule of law, democracy, and helping them to strengthen institutions of transparency, check and balance. I think all of this there are a number of initiatives. I don't want to go into the detail. But perhaps during the question and answer sessions, I'll go to those ones. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Samuel. You indeed raise some challenging issues. So you point to the need for policy coherence that focuses on macroeconomic, fiscal policy, industrial development, labor market policy, and social policy. I suppose the question is, or one question is, how does one work towards policy coherence in a world where government policy making and international policy making to a large extent is divided up into silos and adopts a sectoral approach? So we'll leave that for later. We'll pass on to our third speaker, which is Alfredo Calcagno. Alfredo is the head of the Macroeconomic and Development Policies Branch in the Division on Globalization Development Strategies at UNCTAD. And he leads the team that prepares the trade and development report. Alfredo is an Argentinian economist with a PhD from the University of Paris. He worked at the Argentinian Ministry of Economy, the Central Bank, and the International Economy Center. Alfredo.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation. I I would like to congratulate Unrist and the authors of this book, because this is an important book. I think that it is important because it comes timely at a moment in which we have a debate on these topics. No, it is a contribution to enrich a crucial debate. And it is a debate that is not only academic debate, of course, there are many very interesting theoretical issues, but this is a debate with huge practical consequences. Because this is about development, this is about power, this is about money, and the question then, which is explicitly, you know, in this book, you know, is to what extent the mineral rent can boost countries' development, and in particular by financing its social policy. So we have, in fact, not only one thing, but several important issues that are addressed here. I wish also say that I liked the approach of the book, no? Because here we are addressing an old and new topic at the same time. No? The question of if countries have enough own resources for development, and the question of the commodity curse, of course. The issue was recently put by Jeffrey Sachs when he proposed to finance a big push of investment, you know, in poor countries using foreign resources. He assumed that these poor countries were not able to generate enough domestic savings. And this book shows that it is not true, at least for some of them. Well, I would say several or many of them. No, because when we think of savings, we must always remember that it is not only household savings. It is true that for most of the population of these countries, it would be very difficult to do anything else than eat and cover the basic needs with their revenues. But besides households, you have government savings and you have firms' savings. No, and it is not reasonable to think that a country that is exporting maybe 50, 60, 70% of oil, no, of its GDP in oil, has not savings capacity, that this firm cannot save anything. You cannot think a country like Equatorial Guinea, who exports more or less one barrel per capita per day, no? Because it's about 600,000 barriers and more or less the same number of population, has not capacity to save, would need foreign resources to develop, to have investment, to have social policy. Then that is of course one point, the other is the curse that could be associated to, paradoxically, no, to this wealth. And when I said that, I think the book takes the right angle, the right approach to discuss this point, is because it does not rely on an econometric exercise to say whether this explains that. No, there is a richness and mineral rents that would spoil growth and development. And then you must go case by case. You must analyze. You must analyze countries because you have too many things that interact together. You have a political, social, cultural, historical, economic factors, and then you must really understand what happened. And you must then know the history, know the country, know the case. And then I congratulate also the authors and Katia and the organizer of this book for this approach. Commodity scarce. I think that it is an example of what Karl Marx named commodities fetishism, that is to attribute to a thing, a commodity, what in fact is a social relationship, or in this case also institutions. Because the problem, I don't think, is related to what a country exported when they integrated the international economy. Most developing countries, if not all, defined their economic history depending on this integration into the international economy as exporters. And I don't think, of course, that it is irrelevant what you export, you know, for your development thing. But I think it is not the most important thing. I will try to illustrate the point. For instance, yes, Chile and Bolivia, which integrated the international economy and are still basically mining exporters, had much of their development shaped by that fact. And it was not exactly the same for another country like Argentina, which integrated the international economy as exporter of cereal and meat. And some developing economists like Celso Furtado showed that, yes, that had many consequences, and that in the case of Argentina or Uruguay or the south of Brazil, the fact that they integrated this international economy as exporters in a way generated some spontaneous linkages with the rest of the economy, already with railroads, silos, ports, and maybe more important, migrants, that generated a strong domestic market. And it is also true, as it was said here, that on the other hand, mining exploitations have a tendency to be an enclave, which must lower impact on the infrastructure development that could be used for the rest of the economy, and lower employment creation. But then the big difference between Chile and Bolivia is the role of the state. It was historically that in the case of Chile, they had a government and a state that could function efficiently enough for capturing a large part of the rent and using it for development, and that was not the case of Bolivia. Then, from a development point of view, I would say that the big difference is not between Chile and Argentina. It's between Chile and Bolivia. No? And, only quite recently, Bolivia has be able to benefit more from their own resources, but that has been a very long and persistent factor. Then the basic question is about linkages. How you link the more dynamic sector to the rest of the economy in order to avoid the enclave economy. You can do many things, or at least some things, in terms of generating more value added, of creating some domestic supply for inputs of the mining sector. It is possible, but it is limited. And I fully agree with Samuel and Katia when they spoke about the 1930s, the expression to seed oil. And this is a very particular seed in the sense that it is expected to produce a different entity than the one it comes from. You know, you seed oil and you get something else. To some extent, you must also feed the chicken of the golden eggs. But on a strategic perspective, you must diversify. And this doesn't happen spontaneously. You need to have a development policy on that. Well, UNCTAD has recently worked the last few years, you know, with higher prices, but it did not discuss is changing this rule, including developed countries. No? And very recently, the United Kingdom rose for the second time. The taxes on the North Sea oil, because well, they say there's no reason that a rent that is generated with no responsibility, it is not because of technical innovation that they are gaining more money, and that was not incorporated into the project of investing or not, would go entirely to the firm. So then there is a strong rationale on that. But then you have the other point. Then what to do with that money? And then maybe that is one part of the curse story comes. No? I would say that you already understood that I don't believe in curses at least this kind. No, and particularly from mining, I don't know. Of course, you may have an oligarchy, owners of the mining, but you have a landlord's oligarchy, and they are not much more development friendly than the other one, or democratic, or respectful for environment. On the contrary, sometimes with agriculture you can pollute a larger area. But then, yes, how to avoid the bad use of this? No, and the question is really complicated because, of course. I agree with the main ideas of we must take care of this and that. We must take care of economic stability, counter-cyclical policy, future generations, and the needs you have now. No? Because if you don't have this generation, you don't have the next one. So no, or you don't have in a good shape the next one. So there is a dilemma. I admit there is a dilemma, and I don't have an easy answer to that. Because ideally, you should say you must do everything. You must have a sovereign fund, thinking of a future generation, a stabilization macroeconomic fund in order to smooth expenditure in the economy and avoid pro-cyclical policies. And you must cover the urgent needs you have in terms of infrastructure, social security and social needs and education and so many things. Then, unless you are very few countries like Qatar maybe or Saudi Arabia that you have enough money for everything, you must choose. And this is a difficult choice. And I would say our bias would be to think of the development needs now. In the sense that it is now, if you must think of what is better for long-term development and even for future generations between accumulating foreign assets or developing social expenditure, what is the best of the two things? And it is not a counter-cyclical expenditure. Because if you are covering more people with that cannot have a pension, and you pay for every elderly people some minimum pension, well, you are not going to withdraw that if the prices go down. Or if you incorporate more young people to education, well, you are not going to cut that. It is not a counter-cyclical expenditure. And at the same time, I'm not saying to be pro-cyclical. Of course, it would be very good if we can have some room for maneuver in terms of short-term macroeconomic management. And I think that many of the curse things like Dutch disease can be handled. And we have enough instruments in macroeconomic toolbox for handling that. No? But we still will have this kind of the dilemma or trade-off, no, between some kind of expenditures that are not counter-cyclical and that you can do now because the prices are better. There is also some aspect of analysis, no, to say, well, are we in a top of a cycle of the price that go return to the 1998 level or 2002 level soon, no, or not? Our idea is that the prices may not continue increasing forever or for a reasonably long period of time, but will not return to the old level either. So that at least some part of the new rents, of the new revenues you are getting now, you can use them in long-term needs. And the important point then would be to use them in something that is an investment, in something that will generate a revenue that otherwise would not exist. And in that sense, then you are obtaining sustainability. No, you are not just eating the bread today for starve tomorrow. Then, well, I think then that this is the philosophy we are suggesting. No, in terms of making sure that these rents are supplementary to other income, that they are not substituting government income through taxes or export incomes. No, for that, then you must avoid the Dutch disease. You must have an industrial policy. You must have a fiscal policy that would not rely on these rents. Take this rent as a plus, not as substitute. And I will end saying that the mining rents must not discourage the generation of non-mining resources. It must encourage it. And maybe in a nutshell, it is what I wanted to say today.
Thank you, Alfredo. You covered a lot of ground, and I think it was a wonderful role of being a discussant for Katia's book. You made the point that markets and state market relations are socially and politically constructed. And I think it's important we come back to that. And so we're going to open it up for questions and answers. But what I would like to ask the panelists first is, from the work you've done, what can we say about the political economy of positive policy change? It sounds like we know what the problems are, we know what the policy should look like, but what are the sort of social and political forces that are going to bring that about? And do we have some examples from countries where we think positive things are happening in terms of the political economy or policy change? But before we get to the answers, let's open it up for some questions and answers. Perhaps if we, for comments, perhaps if we take two or three, and then the speakers can answer. Yes. If you could please introduce yourselves.
Okay, my name is Tim Minebois. I'm a student at the Gavi Institute here. I'm also a journalist reporting on extractives in Ghana. Yes, I have two major questions, but I'll be as brief as possible. One issue has been, you know, the financial market. Several organizations, including Publish What You Pay, Norway, published a report on excessive mispricing of crude oil from 2000 to 2010 into the EU and the US, reporting about $110 billion missing. And then you can also talk of global financial integrity. They also give that most resource-rich countries have lost up to $1 trillion owing to most illicit financial flow. So I really wanted to know, if you are to tackle a potent social policy, what can we do to arrest these concerns of illicit financial flows and tax evading and other issues that relates to it? And then the other question also relates to the role of the state. If you look at the case of Ghana, we have the mining revenues, especially going to the central government, and then a few of them going to the sub-national governments. So I think there is a total shift from emphasis into sub-national development. So the government collects it and develops the capital while it leaves the local communities to also suffer. So what social policy can we institute to actually cause sub-national development, where the local governance structures will be empowered enough to contribute? And then a report by Starting Industries Transparency Initiative actually in Ghana reported one issue that the governance at the subnational center actually use the revenues as recurrent expenditure. You receive the mineral revenues and they use it in the administrative work. So how can we also? Thank you.
My name is Kate Gatsahar of Mangta. I have a question about econometric relations between, say, mineral export or production on the one side and poverty reduction. It's been discussed there is perhaps some relationship between mineral production export on the one side and the GDP growth rate. And they're discussing Dutch disease issue and all that. But I just wonder, how about poverty issues? Is it really reducing or not really creating any impact on the status quo of the situation of poverty? That's one question. Second question is ownership issues of the mineral industry. If the government does not access to the revenue of the private sector's ownership of the enclave industry, of the mineral industry, then is it any different? It would be any difference if the ownership is in the hands of government and they get access to the revenue, how much ever it is, directly more accessible to the earnings of that golden egg, chicken. I'm just wondering, ownership is anything to do? And actually, I think if the ownership is government, maybe it's more easier to reduce the Dutch disease issues because sterilization policy could be one possibility of reducing the negative effect.
Okay, is there one more question and then?
Yeah, my name is Lorenzo Previsión. I work for Vorhaus. Foreign Außenpolitik is a Swiss think tank on foreign policy. And my question is about the international initiatives about transparency in extractive industries are related to EITI, for instance, and the Dodd-Frank Act in the US, the European Union Transparency Directives. So my question is, like, how these initiatives are helping finding a solution to this resource course, and what other steps should be done? I refer especially to the Swiss case, where like many mining companies are located in Switzerland, but they are not linked to any of these initiatives.
Good. And
okay. I'm reluctant to ask this question because, this is about the resource curse issue, right? I thought that the resource curse is wrongly asked because it's actually a blessing if you don't have resources. There are only a few countries, five countries or three countries that have managed to develop, And the observation is that they developed because they didn't have resources, but everybody else has the same problem. I haven't read the book, right? But, going by the presentation, everybody has a problem diversifying their economy. Everyone has a problem increasing employment and diversifying employment. Everybody has a problem with the fiscal channel, right? Investing in low-return sectors, right? So I'm wondering whether, how much of this work is applicable to what we don't consider to be resource-rich countries or resource-exporting countries. I'd like to raise a question about the fiscal channel pessimism. Remember, a long time ago, there was export pessimism, right? And now I worry that, and this is the same question that Peter actually asked, right? That to what extent are we, we're now talking about fiscal channel pessimism, right? Just mainly in terms of this resource-rich countries, but maybe in terms of all the other countries, right? That's my question or comment. I don't really know, right?
Good. Okay, would the speakers like to provide some answers to the difficult question?
Peter, all right. Thank you.
I don't want and I can't answer all of the questions, but so I'll pick up the ones that where I think I might contribute. You asked very, very difficult questions. What should we do about the tax evasions? What should we do about this money disappearing through illicit sort of networks and so on? I think there's no simple answer to that. Had there been simple answers, it would have been done. I think many countries are struggling with tax evasions and this illicit disappearing of money. But I think perhaps, again, as Alfredo said,
the issue of transparency, especially in this mineral runs, how much is paid, what is the exact cost, especially how much is being spent and where is this being spent, it's very, very difficult to get this data. They're very secretly held information, so I don't know what can be done. There's no simple answer to that, but I will leave it to the experts to deal with that here. The issue of the econometric issue, whether or not there's a link between mineral resource richness and poverty reduction, I think that's where the main challenge is, basically, because what we see in most of these countries is not only is the economic growth, which is not forthcoming in many of these countries, but also poverty has been increasing in many of these. I could give a very good example. Maybe I always pick on Nigeria, maybe very unfairly, but I think that Nigeria is a classic case where poverty before the discovery of gas, measured by the classic $1 a day or something, it was about 40% of the population, but today it stands at 70%. So this shows you that vis-a-vis the oil, with this extensive exporting of the oil and the Nigerian economy fully becoming dependent on oil, what you see is poverty expanding and inequality also expanding, life expectancy falling down rather than improving. So there are a number of positive things which we shouldn't forget. So that's why you need to be very specific and look into the historical and sociological perspective and do a nuanced analysis. But I think overall, there hasn't been encouraging results in terms of poverty reduction also. That's actually where the main concern is. The ownership issue, this also is something that is being intensely debated as well. Some people are very skeptical that government ownership of the resources or government's control of the resources is disastrous. I think it's Saleh Martin, for example, a very famous economist, actually. In the case of Nigeria, he advocated that we have to find a means whereby we cut off the government from having access at all to the oil, and we have to find a means of directly distributing the money to the citizen. The World Bank, in the case of Chad, for example, gave a very specific rule as to how Chad needs to manage these resources. Now, that means it doesn't go to the extent of Salai Martin's proposal of completely cutting the government out of the management. But in a sense, here, okay, you can manage it, but we're going to have a firm grip on your management. We will control all the gears of economic policy, and you just do what we tell you to do. And I think it didn't work. At some point, Chad has to revolt and get out of the rule. It doesn't work. But it shows you the tendency that simply governments are not capable of managing this or cannot resist the lure to mismanage the wealth. I fundamentally disagree with this view. The whole point, I think the government need to play a great role. The state need to play a great role in managing these resources. And I think when we talk about the management of these resources, it's about what is the best way, what are the best mechanism, both economic but also institutional mechanism, that would enable governments to be able to wisely manage these resources. And I think wise management doesn't mean strictly following this checklist of good management, market-friendly management. It doesn't necessarily mean that. It's what we mean is government actively intervening in the market and commanding the market, not contrary-wise. And that's what we see in most countries happening. In Norway, in Botswana, countries which relatively successfully managed their resources. We see the state playing fundamental role in guiding economic policies and also charting the direction of the economy. So that when we say active and wise management, it doesn't mean the state playing little role, because there's always a lot of controversy on what is the best management. Some advocates that the best governance is no governance at all, meaning you just have to stay out of the market because the market is unequivocally the best allocator of resources, and the government is simply a force of disruption in our market. But the way we see it is now, the role of the government is very fundamental, and more so in mineral-rich countries. So I think, but in terms of, the issue is not who owns it. I think the issue is how would you better manage it. The EITI and all these initiatives which focuses on transparency and so on, I think these are good initiatives, but first, they lack teeth to do anything. In the case of EITI, it emphasizes on transparency on the revenue side. So it requires government, but also mining and industries and so on to inform how much is being paid. So industries mining industries will tell how much have they paid in terms of royalty and so on for the government. And the government also reports saying, well, we have received it this much. So the transparency is just one-sided. Mm-hmm. It's just on the revenue side. Where you have a main problem is on how these resources are being spent. So I think we don't have transparency on the spending side. And as we said, the spending is the main force, how you're using this money. But I would say knowing something a little bit about how much is being paid is already something. So I'm not saying it's useless, but it doesn't take us where we want to go that far. I don't know, perhaps I've forgotten a lot of things, but let me leave the others.
Thank you.
Well, I could just say I agree, and that would be, but I think that I should say a bit more. The what to do with tax evasion, and that is an important point in terms of, okay, you want to get more share, how to do that? And what we did in UNCTAD was a study not only to see how much the governments got, but from which source they got that money. And what we found is that from income taxes, it was very little. Because we all know that transnational corporation has many ways of losing money in the country where they are supposed to get to pay taxes and make profits appear elsewhere, if in a fiscal paradise, tant mieux. And also because many countries, for attracting mining companies, especially during the 90s, where the prices were low and they needed technology that they could not generate themselves, they tried to attract FDI in mining with very, very favorable tax conditions, including special rules for depreciation, carryover of losses forever, and many, many mechanisms not for paying taxes. And also allowing these countries, these firms, to incorporate as a cost, for instance, the interest paid to the home entity, no? to themselves, not a way of sending dividends without calling them dividends, but interest, and so on. We really noticed, and it was, by the way, a big debate in Chile, which is sometimes presented as a good example. I would be careful with that, because the transparency in Chile was the result of a fight. And that has something to do with the political economy of a policy change. That was a secret. Nobody knew how much paid the mining companies. And it was a public servant that said that. You know, in the last, 10 years, the private mining have paid almost nothing. I don't remember how much it was, about $150 million, something like that. Compared to the public company that paid the bulk of the resources from copper in Chile. And then what we say is, well, how to evade how to avoid this evasion? Of course, you should change your law, which is sometimes not easy because you gave, among other things, fiscal stability. Or, in any case, if you can choose, or if you can change your law or for future investment, etc., you must rely more on royalties than on taxes and some kind of ownership, either mixed company, which is in some cases a rule, or public ownership. And again, you will have in the history and in present, you have a very efficient public mining companies and others that are not. But and the other thing that is used in several countries is taxes on exports. So that has also to do with the ownership issues, no? That that were Kate mentioned. Well, yes, it makes a difference. It makes a difference in some cases, even a political difference, because you these are very very important firms that can have play a role in domestic policy. And also macroeconomic difference. If Chile did not went into a hyperinflation in the 80s, despite a huge devaluation of its currency, is because it owned the main exporter of copper at that moment, Codelco. Now the private firms are more important than Codelco, but they had the public firm, meaning that a devaluation improved the fiscal budget, not the fiscal balance, despite the external debt. No? And then they could manage to calm down the inflation and recover late. While in Brazil and Argentina in the 80s, in which that was not the case, a devaluation spoiled completely the public accounts and went then, well, for other reasons as well. No, but then, the ownership has really an important impact, no? Because then the foreign and the fiscal accounts are even more closely linked. About the transparency initiative, yes, I fully agree with the fact that it should not be on a voluntary basis. Not that if you want, you say how much you have paid to the government in taxes. No, that should be mandatory. And well, maybe the Peter question is very provocative: the political economy of policy change. No, and I think we have insisted and we agree that the role of the governments of the states is really crucial in this in these countries, but the government comes from somewhere, and they may defend the national and the interest and the interest of the majority of the population or not, and that results to some extent from social conditions in a country, the role of different actors. I think that one interesting case is that of Bolivia, that it was called, you know, the revolution of the gas. That the political crisis in 2003, it was about who gets the rent of the gas, and you had a social movement that eventually led to a change of government and a change of policy.
Katia.
Yeah, maybe I can just add on to that Peter's question as well. I think the kind of political forces or social movements that might support, you know, that policy change that is needed to make better use of mineral rents or mineral rent development, it's I think it's really a question of, on the one hand, what type of government we have and what type of policies they implement and in what type of international environment. And I think this also links over to that question, what is the relationship between poverty reduction and mineral rents? I think, again, it's like with a resource curse. What is more important, actually, is the broader context of the country. It is not I think, the pure, let's say, existence or the dominance of extractive industries in an economy does not give us a preconceived idea of what this means in terms of poverty reduction. And I think Nigeria is exactly the interesting case to show that, because the Nigeria study we have in the book actually shows that Nigeria went to very different phases in its political economy. And it has been Since it discovered oil, actually, and even before when it drew more on agricultural resources, it has been more and less successful in terms of poverty reduction and social development. But this was actually, the natural resources have been a positive factor. What has been often a negative factor was the policy frameworks that were implemented. And this was, the Nigeria case really shows that the country got into trouble when it went through the oil crisis, the debt crisis, and when it implemented neoliberal austerity politics and stabilization policies that really withdrew investments from the social sectors and led to an explosion, let's say, of poverty rates and inequalities. So I think this is important. And in terms of the political drivers, I think what we can see in many countries that actually the environmental issues and sometimes issues of indigenous rights or other social issues mobilize, let's say, people on the ground. And it's often, and well, Bolivia is a case where it's maybe a broader question of who really captures rents and how they are distributed to the wider population. But I think there is still need for more research on really how to mobilize, let's say, people around the issue of mineral-led development that goes beyond the environmental issues and that touches upon really the broader developmental questions. And what I see at the moment that the developmental discussions around mineral-led development are still a very kind of elite or closed or discussions between economists, international organizations, big players in the sectors, the foreign companies, but that it is not a broad discussion where the citizens, let's say, and the people are very much involved. And I think this is something also we could incentivize to have broader discussions on that. And on the other questions that were raised in terms of ownership, for example, I just want to emphasize that this is one of the key lessons we found in the book, that actually the successful cases show some combination of public ownership and of public companies that compete, actually, with private sector companies. So it is not even the most successful cases, those that maybe have a monopoly as a state company in the sector, but definitely a strong public player in the market. And this is on the one hand because this public company captures a large part of the rent, like in Chile, for example, but now also in Bolivia. And on the other hand, and this is more the Norwegian case, but this might be more difficult for developing countries, because that public oil company, Statoil, has also been a kind of a benchmark or a leading company in terms of technologies and investment and the broader linkages to the rest of the Norwegian economy. So they have set, let's say, a high level. They have been ahead of the curve in terms of the private competitors even. They started a bit lower, but then they kind of overtook their private competitors. So there are, I think, multiple arguments why this is important. Maybe just to finalize the questions of Manuel. Aren't the problems of the mineral-rich countries the problems of all developing countries? Or what is so special about them? I think most of the challenges these countries face, we have discussed it, are kind of general challenges of diversification, employment creation, social development, stability, etc. But, of course, what we can see is that often these problems are more severe, or they have... a higher dimension in these countries. And it's because of the sectoral imbalances we see, that the dynamic sector is this enclave sector. It's not always like that, but often. And, of course, the stability problems because of these huge amounts of foreign exchange that come into often quite low-income countries with a limited toolbox, sometimes within macroeconomic tools to stabilize that. And also because of this high volatility, of course, because of the commodity markets. And I would add also because there is a lot of intervention, of course, into these countries from external actors. And there's a kind of a power game also going on between the multinational companies, between international organizations, etc. So I think this is a kind of a playing field which is not level in a way, and where often the governments kind of lose out and struggle to define a balanced development strategy, which does not pursue only kind of very narrow sector interests or global interests, access to resources, etc. So I think there are special challenges, but there are also signs that these can be addressed in a more or less successful way.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm afraid time is up, so we have to draw this to a close. But thanks for some fascinating answers to some difficult questions. Sometimes I think that maybe our language needs to start to change. You know, we talk a lot about stakeholders and actors, and perhaps the groups that are missing are social movements, political parties, which can make a difference, coalitions, building coalitions. Also, Samuel, what you talked about a lot about was management, but a lot of that sounded very much like what used to be called planning. And maybe planning needs to come back on the agenda. And similarly, we talk about a whole range of policies, but what we hear less about is regulation. And I'm wondering whether there's more of a direct role for regulation or whether we should be emphasizing that a bit more. There's some, Katia, you talked about the unlevel playing field. It reminds me of the discussions yesterday on the guiding principles on business and human rights, where the global framework they came out with has the three pillars: the state duty to protect human rights, business responsibility to respect human rights. And that's where the main focus of the discussion is. And what tends to get ignored is the third pillar, which is the right of victims to effective remedy, where human rights to do with freedom of association, free, prior, informed consent, freedom of assembly, association, expression, etc., are key. And I think always in these discussions we have to be careful that they're not certain blind spots there that we're missing, or we're using a language or discourse that diverts attention from key areas. But thanks to the speakers, thanks to all the participants, and thanks very much to the three speakers.
Check out our other podcasts, available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unris.org. If you have any suggestions for future podcasts, email us at press@unris.org. Thank you for listening.